welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from the golden age of radio. Mark Livonier, your host for this hour of true history. Later on, a newscast from Elmer Davis and an episode of Mr. President. But first, it's Adventures in Research, a syndicated episode from November 19, 1946, called Tooth Powder Mountain.
Adventures in Research.
What in tarnation do you make of that, Lynn?
I don't know, Pard. Queerest looking mountain I ever seen before.
White.
Ghost-like.
This is Paul Shannon introducing another in the series of programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. Today's story by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories, is a strange one indeed. The discovery of Tooth Powder Mountain. Perhaps that name, Tooth Powder Mountain, sounds a little odd to you, and certainly America can lay claim to having, among its many curiosities and freaks of nature, one of the strangest mountains in the world. But let's start at the beginning, back in the not too long ago, when a couple of prospectors looking for gold wearily plodded their way across the Nevada desert land.
It's getting late. Reckon we better bed down for the night?
Yep. Reckon so, Lem. These burrs are plumb tuckered out. Whoa, Daisy. Whoa, Ben.
Reckon this'd be as good place as any. Kind of breezy, you might, but doesn't matter.
Hold on, Lem. What's that up ahead there?
Well, can't see anything, Dave.
Straight on ahead. That kind of hill. Might be we'd find some shelter there for the night.
Say, that's right. Funny, I hadn't noticed it. That's a pretty big hill, I'd say, Dave. You notice anything funny about it? Anything peculiar-like?
Ain't hunting for ghosts, are you, Lem? Looks kind of shiny at that.
Sure does. Maybe it's a mirage. You reckon?
Ain't no mirages this time of night, Lem. It'll be dark any minute now, so let's head for the hill.
Okay, Dave. It sure is peculiar-looking, that hill.
Well, get up, Daisy. Get up, Ed. Come on, get along there.
Whoa there, Daisy. Beth. Well, Pard, here's the hill I saw back there a ways, and it's real.
Sure is. Wonder how come it shines that way.
Reflection of the moonlight, I reckon. Well, I ain't going to worry about it. I'm tired and hungry. So let's get a fire going and rustle up some grub. Whoa, stand still there, Dave.
Well, I'll get a fire going while you unload the burrs, Dave. This where you're going to bed down?
Yep. Right here in this nice deep shadow. Should be the best night's sleep we've had for quite a spell. Whoa, stand still there, Bess, you fool burr, you. Or by thunder, I'll leave them picks and shovels on your back all night. Hurry up with that fire, Lem. I'm starved.
Hey, wake up, Dave. You're going to sleep all day? Wake up.
Oh, sun up already.
You sure can sleep, partner. Just like a baby. I got breakfast gone.
Hey, Lem, what about this hill here?
Hill, did you say? That's a regular mountain.
No wonder it was so shiny in the moonlight. Just look at it. White as all get out. I got to do some prospecting here.
I've done some already, Dave. Get hold of some of that stuff and tell me what you think it is.
Why, it's soft and crumbly-like, almost like a powder. Pretty, too, when you crumble it between your fingers. You know, partner, I reckon this stuff would make a right smart cleaner.
A cleaner? For what?
Just a minute, and I'll tell you. I'm going to try it on my teeth. Yep, feels good.
What are you trying to say, Dave? Dad, blame it, take your finger out of your mouth first.
I said it feels good. That stuff makes a right smart tooth cleaner.
Wonder if it'd clean the pans as well.
A good idea, Lem. Let's try it. Here, get a hold of a pan yourself and try it. There, Lem, I ask you. Did these pots and pans ever look as bright and shiny as they do now?
Nope, not even when they was new, Dave.
Then, by hooky, we didn't discover any gold, but here's something that's just as good. A whole mountain full of tooth powder. And we found it.
Seems to me that'd be a good name for it. The Mountain of Tooth Powder.
We'll mark this spot, Lem, so we'll be able to find it again.
Okay, Dave. Suppose we load up a little of this stuff and take back to town with us next time we're in. Otherwise, won't nobody believe us when we tell them about it.
I wouldn't have believed it myself if I hadn't seen it. Who'd ever think there was such a thing in this country as Tooth Powder Mountain?
Wonder what this stuff is. You got any idea, Dave?
Nope, I ain't. But whatever it is, it sure does a job of cleaning. And we got the whole mountain of it.
Lem and Dave told and retold the story of Tooth Powder Mountain. But mostly their audiences were, to say the least, skeptical about the whole thing.
Well, gee. Are you sure you weren't just seeing things, Dave? Well, they say a fella gets that way after being out in the desert for a while. You better slow down a bit.
And what do you think it was made of, says he? The whole mountain was made of tooth powder.
Blame fools, every one of them. Seeing things, he says. Me that was prospecting around these parts before he was weaned.
There, take it easy, partner. No use getting all head up about it. Come to think about it, it is a mighty tough story to swallow at that.
Ain't it, though? If I didn't know it was all true, I wouldn't believe it myself. But you wait and see, Lem. The day will come when somebody will find a use for that mountain of tooth powder, as soon as they find out what it is.
It took quite a few years for that prediction to come true, but it did. The news about this unique mountain spread. Its fame grew, as did the list of questions about it.
What is this mountain?
When was it made?
Why is it so curious in nature?
Science, ever on the alert to gain new knowledge, to delve into the mysteries of the past and bring them to light that we might better evaluate its meaning, supplied the answers to these questions.
Come in. You're the gentleman from the paper?
That's right, Dr. White. I understand you've been doing some research on the so-called Tooth Powder Mountain in Nevada.
Oh, that's correct. We've made a thorough investigation of it. And now I suppose you want to know what we've discovered.
Yes, I would. And so would a great many people who are interested in such a curiosity. They want to know what it is and where it came from. And what good is it?
Well, the answers are easily supplied. Though I warn you, they may sound rather incredible. Of course, you don't have to believe them, but they're based upon our knowledge of life through the various ages.
I'll accept that, Dr. White. I know that you scientists have dug up a terrific amount of data along those lines. First, what's this tooth powder mountain made of?
Well, it was made by living creatures.
Living creatures?
In fact, the whole mountain is made up entirely of the skeletons of these creatures, which were minute organisms living at the bottom of the ocean.
Oh, but, Doctor, just a minute. This mountain isn't at the bottom of the ocean.
Well, it was once. In fact, Tooth Powder Mountain was once at the bottom of an ocean which covered the plains of Nevada. When the ocean, for various geological reasons, disappeared, the mountain remained, a mountain of marine skeletons.
I understand what you meant now when you said the answers to the questions are rather incredible. But you said these were living creatures.
Well, they were living then, when the plains of Nevada were at the bottom of the ocean. These creatures, known to science as diatoms, are incredibly tiny. and multiply with great rapidity. However, they live very short lives, and thus when their short span of life was up, their skeletons sank to the ocean's bed to pile up there.
Yes, I see the picture now. And these diatoms just piled up one on top of another until they made a mountain.
Exactly. And that went on year after year for heaven knows how many centuries.
It would have to take centuries to make such a pile as that. How small did you say they were, Doctor?
Oh, they're extremely minute. It would require about 200 of them lined up to cover an inch. Moreover, even though they live individual lives, these diatoms are most often found in clusters, in colonies, or living in chains.
Which accounts for the piling up of such a mountain as this tooth powder affair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, these tiny creatures belong to a bygone day, Doctor? Is that the story?
Oh, by no means. Diatoms are not to be thought of as organisms that once lived and no longer exist today.
Well, how do you mean? I don't quite see what you mean.
I mean that diatoms are to be found everywhere that water is found.
Oh, then they're still in existence today.
They existed yesterday, are existing today, and will be tomorrow. And they're still multiplying, still dying, and their skeletons are still sinking to ocean beds.
Well, now, that's a story worth telling, Doctor. Now all that remains is to know what uses can be made of this mountain. What's it good for?
Why don't you go on out there, young man, and see for yourself?
Good idea. I think I will. So this is the celebrated Tooth Powder Mountain, eh? It's quite a hill, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Now, we've been whittling it down bit by bit for a long time now. But, as you say, it's still quite a hill.
Mr. Yates, as superintendent in charge of all these mining operations here, I guess you're the man who can give me the answer to a question about this mountain.
Well, I'll try. I've been on this job for quite a spell. Well, what's your question?
Well, I know the history of Tooth Powder Mountain, how it was discovered by a couple of gold prospectors and all that.
Yes.
And I know the scientific angle, what the mountain is made of and how it came about. Now I want to know, what's this stuff used for? What good is it?
You mean, what isn't it used for? Man, I could give you a list of uses a mile long and still not count them all.
You mean to say this stuff is that valuable?
It sure is. Those old prospectors discovered that it had cleaning properties way back. Well, it still has. Of course, today it's dug out, sent to the refinery, and is ground to a fine powder. Sterilized and all that.
Well, what do you know? Then what?
Then it's used as a base for a great many preparations. Shoe blackening for one, white cleaners, nail polishes, and all scores of other similar items.
It started out as a cleaner and is still in the cleaning business, eh?
Yes, that's right. To date, we've taken out millions upon millions of pounds from the mountain, but as you can see, it hasn't made much of a dent so far.
It's amazing. From where I stand, I'd say you've got billions of pounds to go yet.
Yes, we sure have. Each year, more millions of pounds are dug out of the mountain, and each year finds new uses for it. Uses that reach into everyone's life, in some way or other.
These scientists never give up once they get hold of a problem, or a substance they can use for something or other. And having found one use, they go ahead and discover a million other uses.
Yes, don't they, though? And we all benefit from their work.
You bet. One more question, Mr. Yates.
Yes?
I guess this substance is pretty rare, all right, and there's plenty of it right here.
Yes.
But what do you do when the mountain gives out?
Well, we start digging below the ground. Scientists have been all over this Tooth Powder Mountain, checking, experimenting, and they tell us that the base of this mountain lies many feet below the level of the earth. At least, that's the way they have it estimated.
Well, they should know. So when you get through on top, you start digging below.
Right.
Okay, then what?
Well, the rest of the story we leave to the scientists. By that time, they'll have a substitute. Or maybe they'll have found a way to create the substance themselves, artificially.
Maybe, who knows? Well, thanks, Mr. Yates. I guess that gives me the answers about Tooth Powder Mountain. Sure is one of nature's curiosities if I ever saw one.
And that's today's story by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. Be sure to join us again next week for another interesting story by Dr. Thomas on Adventures in Research.
Adventures and Research on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated episode from November 19, 1946. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Lipponier. Now, in terms of broadcasts that have survived from radio's golden era, it's almost a wonder that so many were saved from the CBS radio network and their newscasts from Elmer Davis from 1939 to about 1942. Here's one of them from October 4th, 1939.
8:55 Eastern Time, and Columbia and its affiliated stations bring you Elmer Davis and the news.
With Hitler's peace offer expected before the end of the week, either directly or through the mediation of Mussolini, voices were raised both in London and Paris today, urging that it shouldn't be rejected without careful study. In London, it was the once powerful voice of former Premier David Lloyd George, who now represents a party of only four members in the House of Commons, but found scattering support from members of other parties. What Mr. Lloyd George asked was that if an offer came through Italy or Russia, those powers should be regarded as neutrals and that, quote, we should not come to a too hurried conclusion, unquote. Mr. Chamberlain didn't seem to think that any such proposals would be offered, but promised that the British government would not be in a hurry if the proposals required serious consideration. This seems to have roused some suspicion that the government was weakening, in spite of Mr. Chamberlain's earlier remark that no mere assurances from the present German government could be accepted by us. For later in the day, an official statement was issued that the reply to Lloyd George did not mean any change in the attitude of the British government, which, as Mr. Chamberlain put it, is that the rule of violence must cease and the word of governments once pledged must henceforth be kept. Lloyd George himself had said that if peace depends on the word of Hitler, we must proceed till we get some more assured guarantee. In Paris, 43 members of the Chamber of Deputies who belonged to the lately dissolved Communist Party and now to its successor, the Workers and Peasants Party, said that there should be no offhand rejection of peace proposals without looking them over. This immediately stirred conservative papers in Paris to denounce the ex-communists as agents of the enemy, and they talked of a trap laid by the Coalition of the East. This is stronger language than the British are using about Russia at present. The Russians, however, are using strong enough language about England. Now that Russia has brought Estonia under complete control and is apparently about to do the same with Latvia and Lithuania, the communist newspaper Izvestia publishes an article accusing England and other capitalist powers of trying for many years to convert the Baltic republics into vassal areas. Details are not given, but presumably this refers to British operations through the Baltic states against communist Russia 18 or 20 years ago. At any rate, what Russia is doing this week is represented as liberation of the Baltic states. In Berlin, German officials say that the talks of Hitler with Count Ciano, the Italian foreign minister who has now gone home, dealt not only with a peace offensive, but with a possible intensification of the war if the peace move is rejected. They speak, too, of measures for the preservation of common Axis interests. And the German newspapers suggest that if the peace offer is refused, Italy may enter the war. But all this talk of what Italy may do comes so far from Berlin. Rome is very reserved about it. The Senate was in recess today on account of the death of Senator Logan of Kentucky, so Washington had time to digest the speeches made yesterday for and against the neutrality bill by Senators Pittman and Borah. Mr. Borah's speech, it was felt, might have influenced a scattered few wavering senators, but administration leaders still expect the bill to pass whenever it gets to a vote. The negative policy of this bill is, of course, supplemented by the more positive program adopted by the Inter-American Conference, which was discussed on this network earlier in the evening in a broadcast from Panama by Undersecretary of State Sumner Wells. The conference decided, he said, that as a matter of continental self-protection, the American republics were entitled to keep American waters free from belligerent activities. But it looks as if there will be some difficulty in enforcing the neutrality of this 300-mile-wide belt of ocean around the Americas. We're entitled to it if we can get it. But how are we going to enforce this very great extension of national sovereignty over the high seas? Mr. Wells says that the 21 American republics, acting through the president of Panama, will make a joint representation to the belligerents, tell them what we want. But suppose they don't do it. President Roosevelt was asked that today at his press conference and replied that the appearance of a belligerent vessel inside the safety zone would not involve a question of war. That is, we tell them to keep out, but if they come in anyway, it doesn't yet appear what we intend to do about it. More hopeful were the promises that American shipping facilities to Latin America will be increased. We'll have plenty of ships to spare after the neutrality bill goes through, for it would seem to leave little room for American seaborne trade with even the neutral nations of Europe. And Mr. Roosevelt said today that at the next regular session of Congress, he would ask for $400 million additional credit authorization for the Export-Import Bank to finance our trade with Latin America.
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Elmer Davis and the news from October 4th, 1939 on CBS, a glimpse at the global news of the day. We conclude this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday with the very first broadcast of Mr. President, running 214 episodes strong on the ABC Radio Network. This first show premiered on June 26, 1947.
The following program is transcribed from its earlier network release. American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations present Mr. President, starring Edward Arnold. Mr. President, at home in the White House, the elected leader of our country, our fellow citizen and neighbor. These are little known stories of the men who've lived in the White House. Dramatic, exciting events in their lives that you and I so rarely hear. The true human stories of Mr. President. Let's visit Mr. President in the White House. It's evening. Only one window shows a light, a study on the ground floor. We find ourselves at the front door.
Come right in, please. The president's expecting you. Through that door, please.
I'll go right in. Some business for you, Mr. President.
Hello. Sit down, won't you? Why, of course it's all right. You know, before I moved in here, I had the idea that the president is somehow more than a human being. But believe me, he isn't. I get aches and pains just the way you do. All kinds of things happen at the White House here, things people never hear about. Let me tell you a true story that's hardly known to all. Now, which president was it when it actually happened? I'll tell you later on. But meanwhile, see if you can guess. It started the evening I came back to the White House after taking a long, brisk walk.
President.
Hello, Captain Drew.
Are you all right, Mr. President?
Well, don't I look all right?
Yes, sir. Only, where are McGrath and Cooper?
Ah, Captain, they're fine young fellows. They're the most pleasant bodyguards you ever assigned to me.
Pleasant be? They're not supposed to let you out of their sight.
I assure you, they didn't do it on purpose.
Oh, not again, Mr. President.
You'd have appreciated my strategy, Captain. I walked into the swamp, the one by the river. They did exactly what I expected. They ran around to the other side to pick me up again, but I turned right around and came out where I went in. You know, Hannibal did that once to the Romans. I hate being followed, Captain.
But we've got to guard you, sir. Yesterday, a bomb came in the mail. This morning, more of those threatening letters. Oh, McGrath and Cooper are going to catch it from me.
Don't be hard on them.
And I'm going to catch it from Miss Sarah.
Oh. Well, I won't tell her if you won't.
I can't fool Miss Sarah, sir. And neither can you.
You know, I was enjoying myself thoroughly until you said that, Captain.
I'm sorry, Mr. President.
Well, however, it was fun while it lasted. Can't you just see poor McGrath and Cooper running around and around that swamp? And waiting for me to come out? Good night, Captain.
Good night, Mr. President.
Oh, Captain.
Yes, sir?
You won't say anything to Miss Sarah?
I'll do my best, but...
Good night, Captain.
Your breakfast, Mr. President.
Oh, come in, Ralph. You can push those papers off the table.
They're all about the coal strikes, sir.
I know them by heart, and much good it does me. Push them aside.
Yes, sir. The senator's on his way upstairs, sir.
Oh, he's back from New York?
Evidently. Here he is, sir.
Good morning, Mr. President.
Oh, good morning.
May I join you for breakfast?
Well, isn't this our regular day, John? Sit down.
Yeah, thanks.
A fried ham this morning, gentlemen.
Well, I'm not very hungry.
I love fried ham, Ralph.
With eggs on top like the sun coming up.
No, I'm not hungry, really.
Oh, but I am, Ralph.
On marmalade and coffee, too.
You'll pardon me if I begin, Mr. President.
Well, I suppose I ought to eat something.
Yes, sir.
Ralph.
Sir?
My toast. Where's the butter?
Your diet, Mr. President.
Now, where did Miss Sarah get that idea?
So you want a diet, too? My wife made me adopt hers.
My wife, too.
This is very humbling experience, Ralph.
Humbling, sir?
I'm president of the United States. I'm responsible for millions and millions of people, but I can't get butter on my toast.
It just goes to show you, sir, there's no such thing as unlimited power.
Yeah, you're right. Newton learned about gravity from an apple. We learn about power from toast.
And sometimes the most baffling problems yield to the most simple solutions, Senator.
Mr. President, I'm glad to find you in this mood.
What?
I chatted with Captain Drew on my way in.
Oh, I think I know what's coming.
Did he tell you of all the angry letters last week?
The usual thing, John.
But so many more from the coal states blaming you for the strike going on. From the farm states because prices have crashed. Many of those letters threaten your life, Mr. President.
Well, what good would it do killing me?
And there was a bomb in the mail the other afternoon.
John, I'm not responsible for every crazy fool.
You are responsible for your own safety.
It's not as serious as all that.
Don't you realize what would happen to the country if you... No, one shot would be enough. In this crisis, an assassination would bring chaos, even anarchy. The future of this nation is at stake.
I know.
Coal is up to $20 a ton. School to having to close, hunger, illness. But it's not only the miners. There's not a single person untouched by this tragedy. This economic stalemate has affected every home in the nation. People's nerves are wearing thin.
No, you don't have to tell me all of that.
Beg your pardon.
More coffee, gentlemen?
Please.
Make mine black, Ralph.
Yes, sir.
John, what luck did you have?
Hendricks came down with me on the train from New York last night.
In response to my interpretation?
Yes, with a new plan for ending the strike. It was prepared by Hendricks and the leading operators.
They aren't giving in.
I told Hendricks I was breakfasting with you, so he gave me this piece of paper for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's short enough.
Oh, yes, it's short enough.
Now, let's see. As representative of the mine operators, he asked me to appoint a 7-man commission to arbitrate the strike. But there's no representative of labor provided for.
No, sir.
Well, we'll never get the men to go back to work unless their views are heard in all fairness.
No.
Almost a year ago, we started trying to get these people to agree and to get them together. We failed. And always for the same reason. This plan isn't really new. It leaves us exactly where we were at the beginning.
Maybe, Mr. President, but maybe there's something we can
do.
No,
not at this time, at any rate.
Well, then I'll be going. I'm sorry my news wasn't better.
Well, you did your best, John. Thank you.
Good day, Ralph.
Good day, Senator. Mr. President, before you go downstairs...
What is it, Ralph?
Miss Sarah, sir.
Well, what about her? Oh, I'd forgotten. She's angry, eh?
You know how she gets, sir.
Well, I'd rather face an angry mob outside the White House than Miss Sarah when she's... Well, you know.
You should have thought of that last night, sir, before you lost the guards in the swamp.
Well, Miss Sarah, or no Miss Sarah, I've got the coal strike to settle. Good morning, Miss Sarah.
Good morning, Mr. President. Excuse me.
What?
Your tie was crooked.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Now, I want you to take
Did you sleep well, Mr. President?
Oh, yes. Fine. I want you to...
Don't look as if you had.
Well, I'm never boisterous in the morning.
I can tell when you've had enough sleep and when you haven't. And why?
That's it, exactly. I want you to get Mr. Hendricks...
When you don't sleep well or enough, there's usually a reason.
Of course. The coal strike.
Conscience.
What?
The uneasy conscience of a small boy with evil in his heart.
Oh, what towering nonsense.
Small boys of your type think it amusing to play pranks that worry all of us have to death.
Now, Miss Sarah...
If I begged you once, I've begged you 100 times. Don't go around without your bodyguard.
Well, it's irritating to be followed.
That's not important.
Oh, isn't it?
It's not you they're guarding. It's the President of the United States.
Well, he can be irritated, too.
And last night, losing those 2 men in the swamp, if ever I heard a childish trick...
You know, I was testing out some military strategy. Hannibal did it to the Romans. He went a little way into a swamp...
Mr. President... Please.
Forgive me this time, Miss Sarah.
It isn't a joke. With that bomb in the mail, the crazy letters threatening your life.
Miss Sarah, I want you to call up Alvin Hendricks at his hotel. Have him come over as soon as he can. Also call up the senator. I'm ready for the next step in the cold strike.
You've decided what to do?
Miss Sarah, I'm sorry I distressed you over the guards.
I'm sorry I spoke so harshly, Mr. President.
Shake hands.
Yes. You wanted me to call the senator.
Yes, and have him come back at the same time Hendricks does. Miss Sarah, I thought I was licked. Now I think we're going to get somewhere.
President, Mr. Hendricks.
Now, Mr. Hendricks, good morning.
Mr. President.
I hope we make more progress today than we did the last time.
I hope so, too, Mr. President.
Good. Now, your plan asks me to set up a commission. It's to include an army or navy engineer, a mining engineer, a coal merchant, a federal judge, a churchman, a government representative, and a sociologist. With all these, I agree.
You're doing the country a service, sir.
But you've got to go further.
Further? How?
The miners have to be represented, too.
You mean add a representative of the miners to the commission?
This plan won't work unless you do.
Why not? The entire anthracite industry is behind it.
Mr. Hendricks, we've tried time and time again to settle this strike without sitting down with both sides represented. I'm convinced that unless a representative of labor has a chance to meet with you, this plan is doomed to failure, too.
Mr. President, ours tied... The coal operators...
Mr. Hendricks, the president cannot take sides.
We agree to accept the commission's decisions. Why can't the miners?
Mr. Hendricks, this strike has lasted for months and months. I want the operators of the miners to get together. The price of coal is skyrocketing. Industry is at a standstill. People all over the country are suffering. Winter is coming. And you know what that means. Cold, hunger, illness. Schools will have to close. Hospitals will be affected. These are intolerable conditions, human factors. And they outweigh any other consideration.
We're upset about these things, too, Mr. President.
Then compromise.
Well...
You've got to.
We respectfully suggest that you appoint any individuals you like, as long as they stay within the 7 categories named in the plan. But to add a new one now...
In plain language, Mr. Hendricks, you flatly refuse.
Yes. We've already come so far, Mr. President. Can't you understand our position?
I can't accept a plan I know will fail.
And apparently this discussion is getting us nowhere.
I agree with you, Mr. Hendricks.
Good day, sir.
Good day, sir. Goodbye, Mr. Hendricks.
Miss Sarah.
Mr. President.
Miss Sarah.
Coming.
Mr. President, the country will fall into chaos.
Wait and see. Ready, Miss Sarah?
Yes, sir.
A letter to Mr. Hendricks. Dear Mr. Hendricks, I have carefully considered our talk this morning and I have decided to accept your plan as it stands.
As it stands.
Mr. President, you dismissed Hendricks not 30 seconds ago. You could have accepted the plan then without arguing about it.
Oh, no. I got him to say what I wanted him to say.
What?
That as long as I stayed within the 7 categories, they'd accept any individuals I name.
I don't understand.
Well, listen to the rest of the letter. These will be my appointments. Military engineer... Brigadier General John M. Wilson. Mining engineer, E.W. Parker. Judge, George Gray. Coal merchant, Thomas H. Walker. Bishop John Spaulding. United States Commissioner, Carol P. Wright. And as the sociologist...
What?
Sociologist. S-O-C-I-O-S.
Oh, I know how to spell it. I just didn't understand you.
As to the sociologist, you will meet him at the time of our conference in Silly Oz.
Mr. President, who is this sociologist and why are you keeping him such a secret?
The sociologist will be E.E. Clark, Grand Chief of the Order of Railroad Conductors.
E.E. Clark? But, Mr. President, he's the very kind of man Hendricks and his crowd have refused to accept.
You heard Hendricks say they would accept any sociologist I name. Do you know what a sociologist is, John?
Well, I...
A sociologist is an authority on social problems and conditions.
Thank you, Miss Sarah.
And, John, wouldn't you say that the head of the conductors' union is an authority on social problems and conditions?
Well, I suppose the miners will accept Clark.
Why, certainly. They know him and respect him.
But will Hendricks and the operators?
When they sit down with him, it'll be too late to back out.
Yes, but if they do back out, if the whole plan fails...
I'm president of all the people, not only some of them. I'll call out the army and operate the mines myself.
Excuse me, Senator. Your next visitor, Mr. President.
Good luck, Mr. President. I'll be anxious to know of the result. Good day, Miss Sarah.
Goodbye,
Senator.
Good day,
Senator.
Well, Miss Sarah, what next?
You have a full list ahead of you, Mr. President. A congressional delegation from Iowa on behalf of federal road building. After luncheon, a committee of the Women's League for Better Citizenship to present you with a plaque. Of him, Mr. President.
And that's the last time I make appointments after dinner.
Well, I'm sorry. You have one more.
Oh, Lord, no.
He's due in a moment or so on an appointment made by one of our congressmen. I'd better ask him to come back to me.
No, no, it's all right. What's his name? What does he want?
Well, his name is Carlson. He's a farmer, I believe.
Well, there's no need for you to stay, Miss Sarah.
Oh, it's only 9 o'clock. Besides, I have a little more work to do.
Well, you've done enough for today, Miss Sarah.
I'll be in my office, Mr. President. I'll close the door. You won't even know I'm there.
Well, you won't disturb me.
Oh, Curry is the guard in the corridor tonight, so if you take a walk later...
I know, I know. Curry? Curry?
Oh, yes, Mr. President?
Is that you pacing up and down?
Yes, sir. Orders, Mr. President.
I see. Very well, Curry.
Yes, sir.
Oh, Curry.
Yes, Mr. President.
Curry, Captain Drew was telling me your wife's quite ill, isn't she?
Oh, yes, sir, she is.
It must worry you a good deal, huh?
Oh, she's a rare woman, sir.
Well, why don't you run on home and see how she's feeling, Curry?
Well, I'm not off duty till morning, sir, and Captain Drew told me that...
Oh, no one will be the wiser, Curry. You know, take your time. Come back later, and if Captain Drew asks any questions, I'll take the responsibility. Now, go ahead, Curry.
Well, all right, sir. Thank you very much, sir. I won't be long. I'll go the back way.
Yeah, that's better. Oh, come in. Curry, I thought that you were... Oh. Well, who are you?
Excuse me, Mr. President. I have an appointment. Usher told me to come in.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, come in. It's Mr.
Carlson, sir. Emory Carlson.
Oh, yes, yes.
I had a hard time getting this appointment, Mr. President. You haven't got much time for people like me.
Well, certainly you understand that.
I only understand one thing. You're against us. I don't have to understand anything else.
Us?
Look at my hands, Mr. President.
Well?
I got that way from plowing, from hoeing hard ground, from years of work wiped out by the banks.
Well, sit down, won't you? Let's talk this thing over.
Talk? I'm not here for that, Mr. President. Only one thing I'll say. It's got to be done.
What?
Move away from that desk.
Why?
Move away from that desk.
Very well. Tell me, what's got to be done?
You're our enemy. You're bad for the country. You've closed down the mines. You're letting the banks take our farms. It's bad to have an enemy. It's worse to have a friend turn into an enemy.
I don't understand you.
Yes, you do, Mr. President. Farmers believed in you once, just like the miners did. And look at us now. In debt, farms taken over by the banks, squeezing us to death. Miners starving, too. You want it that way, but it can't go on.
I don't want it that way.
What turned you against us, Mr. President? What did we do to you? Why are you fighting us?
I'm not.
We'd have had our farms now if you didn't prevent it.
I prevent it? How?
Just siding with them, with the banks.
Oh, you're wrong.
Look at this, Mr. President.
A gun is dangerous only according to the man holding it.
This gun is dangerous.
You'll be caught. There's a guard right outside that. There are guards all over the ground.
There's no guard outside. I came in that way.
Then the noise of the shot.
Mr. President, I'm going to kill you.
Why?
You're my enemy. Our enemy.
No.
For 20 years, I worked to keep my own farm. Now it's been taken from me because I couldn't pay my taxes and the mortgage. No one will give me credit. What chance have the farmers got as long as this strike goes on? What chance has anybody got?
What can I say to you? What can I possibly say?
It's late for that question.
The coal strike will be ended.
In favor of the miners and of us. What about us?
The whole country will go back to work.
Fine words. We've heard them all.
Let me prove what I say is true. Let me go into the next room.
No, no, you don't.
To get a letter to show you?
You'll signal a guard.
Mr. Carlson, behind you is an open door to a small room where my daily records are kept. There's a large flat desk with several filing trays. In one of them are copies of a letter I wrote today. That's what I want you to see.
Don't press any buttons.
There aren't any in there. Is that all right?
All right. Walk past me. Just to the door.
Here?
I'm behind you. Walk ahead to that desk.
Well, it's about 1, 2, 3, 4 paces.
All right. Now, get that letter.
You know, if I die, the vice president moves in here. That's the law.
I remember that from school.
He'd have to do about the same as I do. He couldn't help the farmers or force the miners and operators to settle.
They could make a law.
The president can't compel anyone to do anything. Only the people can make a law. Oh, here we are.
Come back in this room. Careful.
I'm being very careful.
Put it down on the desk. Now step back. Further, Mr. President.
Read the letter. I won't jump at you.
I'm reading it.
I promise you I won't move.
What's this mean?
We're forming a commission to end the strike.
A commission?
Yes, the operators have steadily refused to meet with a representative of labor. But they have agreed to meet with a sociologist.
Well?
If you'll read that letter, you'll notice that the name of the sociologist is left blank.
Yes, I see.
Well, just for your information, Mr. Carlson, and confidentially, our sociologist will be E.E. Clark, Grand Chief of the Order of Railroad Conductors.
A union?
Yes. The operators have agreed to meet. If that doesn't work, I'm calling out the army to work the mines. When coal is coming out of the ground again and people are working again, won't they be able to buy more food? Your corn and wheat and everything else the farmer grows? Does that look as if I'm letting you down?
Great. I get crazy. A man gets tied into a nut. He has to do something.
Mr. Carlson, you realize that I have to turn you over to the guards.
Yes, I know.
Threatening the life of the president is... Mr. Carlson, I think you'd better give me that gun.
Yes, sir. I don't know where I was wrong. I guess it's too late to be sorry. Go ahead, call the guard.
You know, Carlson, I believe you're sincere. You were wrong, but... See here, Carlson, go out that door and down the hall. At the end of the corridor, you'll find a guard. Ask him to take you to Captain Drew. Turn yourself over to the captain. And then I'll... Well, it may go easier on you that way.
I'm still glad I came here, Mr. President. Because I found out we were wrong about you. God bless you, sir. And help you.
Good luck, Carlson. Why, Miss Sarah, I thought you'd gone.
I've been working. Where's Curry?
Curry?
Oh, he,
Didn't I hear you and Captain Drew talking in the corridor?
Hmm? Yes. He was asking me a lot of questions.
Oh.
Oh, you must be very tired, Miss Sarah.
Questions about what?
Miss Sarah, I'm worried about you. You must be very tired.
You're awfully anxious to get rid of me.
Oh, no, not really. Sit down. Shall I send for some tea?
I could swear you've been upset by something. Don't you want to tell me? Don't you think you ought to?
Miss Sarah, I don't know what you... Oh, the door. Yes, come in.
Oh,
yes. Oh, Curry. Well, Curry, thanks for looking in. Everything is fine. Thank you, Curry. And good night, Curry. Now, Miss Sarah, I want you...
Pardon me, Mr. President. I just want to give you this, sir.
Oh, thank you, Curry. Thank you very much. Well, good night, Curry.
Open it, Mr. President.
Open it?
Curry obviously hopes you will.
thank you, Miss Sarah.
Cookies.
My wife wanted you to have them, sir. She was that grateful.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Curry. And don't mention it. By all means, don't mention it.
I told her how you'd let me off, sir.
No, don't mention it, Curry. Don't mention
well,
it.
Well, anyway, thank you, sir. And good night, sir.
Yeah, good night. Miss Sarah, do you have a cookie?
Why wouldn't you tell me about Carson of your own accord?
Miss Sarah, you were eavesdropping.
You were afraid I'd be angry about Curry.
Oh, I wish you'd take a cookie.
A small boy, a little boy, so pleased with his games, outwitting his elders that he doesn't care what he does with his own life.
Well,
I
what?
I listened at that door, frozen stiff. Any sound would have set that gun off, and I... Mr. President, I've got to make you see it. One shot from that gun tonight, and everything you're doing would be smashed. So much depends on your life. And it isn't your life. It's the miners and their families, the farmers and the senator and Captain Drew. You don't belong to yourself. You belong to all of us. You've got to be careful.
Well, I'm sorry. I promise you I will be from now on. Why, Miss Sarah, you're crying.
Now, I know what it means when they say enough to make the angels weep.
And you are an angel, Miss Sarah. You're right, and this will never happen again. Forgive me, please.
Forgive you? You? I just can't stand another minute of it, and I'm going home. And if that Curry ever moves from here for the rest of his life, I'll have him skinned alive.
Good night, Miss Sarah. The miners and the operators did accept my appointment with Mr. Clark as the sociologist. Alvin Hendricks was certainly surprised when he recognized Clark as head of the conductors' union, but he stuck to his word. The commission was set up and the strike was settled. That was the first time a thing like that was ever done, and so we did make a little progress. After that, too, I was careful not to be careless anymore about the guards. I learned my lesson. Besides, I hated to see Miss Sarah get so upset. But it was fun leading McGrath and Cooper around that swamp the way Hannibal did the Romans. Have you figured out yet who all I was when all that happened? It really did happen, you know. Yes, it's a true story. And it happened in 1902. And it was Teddy Roosevelt who had my job then. Yes, when Theodore Roosevelt was Mr. President. Drop in again next week, won't you? I've got another story I think you'll enjoy. Good night.
Edward Arnold will soon be seen with Clark Gable, Deborah Carr, Sidney Greenstreet, and Adolph Monju in Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's production of The Hucksters. Mr. President, starring Edward Arnold, is presented each week by the American Broadcasting Company. It is produced by Robert G. Jennings, directed by Dwight Houser. Tonight's script by Paul Milton was based on two incidents in the life of Theodore Roosevelt. Music was composed and conducted by Basil Adlam. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
Mr. President, on Tuned to Yesterday from June 26, 1947 on ABC, the series would wrap up in September of 1953. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to join us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening. Thank you.